Hello, this is the Weebertarian podcast, and I know I've been gone for a while. Don't really have an excuse. I was just being lazy. I spent a good deal of time playing Albion Online. Well, not a good deal. It was probably a couple months. It was a pretty fun game, but I didn't really have a lot of people to play with. And then I ended up joining a guild, which I didn't really enjoy being in that guild very much. But anyway. So let's see. First off, I want to issue something of a correction on one of my previous episodes. I had said in a previous episode that one of the things that was a cause of the Civil War was that the South allowed slaves to vote. And that was entirely incorrect. It was a really stupid mistake. I should have damn well known better. it was that the South wanted slaves to count towards representation in Congress or something like that, so that they would have more representatives in the South. And the North didn't want slaves to count towards representation because they thought that they would the South if they that if slavery was allowed in the Western territories, then they would have more representation in the Congress. So, anyway, issue a bit of a correction there. And then there was also this, this article I was reading today, which I kind of wanted to comment on. What was it? Here it is. This is an article in fee.org by Robert P. Murphy. It's a really pretty old article, but they just reposted it recently for some reason, and I read it, and it's a pretty good article. There was just something I wanted to comment on. So the article is Extreme Poverty Rates Plummet Under Capitalism. So he makes some points here. One of them is actually like a really, hold on. Don't allow. Okay. So the first point is one that like is when, my initial introduction to economics was through, on Audible. Like I had a subscription and that gives you one credit per month. And, I thought the best value for that one credit, since you know the premium subscription that gives you one credit per month is $15 a month. So the only way to actually get value out of that is to buy audiobooks that sell for more than $15. Otherwise, you're spending more on the credit than you would if you just bought the audiobook outright if it's a less than $15 audiobook. And on Audible, some of the most expensive audiobooks are the ones from the Great Courses, which are, I think the, but well, so the one of the audiobooks I bought from the Great Courses was the economics audiobook, and that was my first introduction to economics. And it's like something like 60 hours and is allegedly equivalent to having taken an economics course in college. And it's you know, the lectures in that audio, it's not really an audiobook. It's like 60 hours of lectures or 80 hours of lectures, something like that, given by an actual professor of economics that teaches at college. And the first point made in this article was actually a point made, like, in one of the earliest chapters of that series of lectures, which is simply that, you know, the living standards under capitalism have improved vastly since its implementation. That, you know, the typical question posed in an economics class would be something like, would you rather be poor or middle class now, or like a millionaire in 1900. And, you know, if you think about it, you're actually living better as a poor or middle class person now than you would be as a millionaire in 1900. You have access to a far higher standard of living, even as a poor or middle class person, than you would as a rich person in 1900. Even if, you know, you might live in like some small apartment, you have access to much greater life improving things than, you know, you would have in 1900. And that's sort of the first point made in this article by Robert P. Murphy. The point is, yes, it's true that the rich tend to get richer, but the poor get richer too, especially if we look at the time span of decades or longer. And if we focus our attention on people living in countries where governments adhere to basic respect for the rule of law and property rights, consider even those who would be called poor in today's Europe or the United States have a standard of living that would astonish the nobles entertained in the courts of Versailles of Louis XIV. Blah, blah, blah. Won't go through all the details of that. And then the second point, capitalism and economic stagnation. So he says here, okay, sure, you might hear inventors make discoveries every now and then, so over the course of centuries that piles up and even average people end up richer. That's just the operation of science and technology. But he's basically trying to illustrate the sort of dialogue you might hear from somebody that says the rich get richer and the poor get poorer under capitalism. So this would be like what he says their response would be if you were to make that sort of a claim that, oh, hey, we're living much better, even the poor are living much better now than, you know, the rich were hundreds of years ago. Hold on, I'm going to get a drink. So in the article, he basically then sort of tries to take the sort of position that somebody arguing that might make, which is that inventors make discoveries every now and then, so over the course of centuries that piles up and even average people end up richer. That's just the operation of science and technology. But I'm talking about the economic process under unregulated capitalism, which is characterized by stagnation for most participants. So that's the argument he thinks somebody might make counter to his claim that the poor are much better off today than even the rich were hundreds of years ago. So then he goes on to say, actually, that summary gets things backwards. For most of recorded history, humans had very slowly rising living standards, but then material progress suddenly exploded. And then he shows this graph that shows the GDP per person, and all the figures are adjusted for 2012 dollars. And it basically shows almost a flat line for almost 1,000 years. And then suddenly around 1800, there's this upward explosion of GDP per person. And this is supposed to correlate with the implementation of capitalism. Now, while that's true, I'd like to posit that somebody might argue at that point, well, one, the correlation is not causation. So it might not necessarily be capitalism which causes that explosion in wealth even for the poor, but that it was, you know, sort of what's the term for the era? It's not the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, you know, so people started, you know, doing more research in scientific fields and everything like that, which then caused an explosion in technology that had never before been seen. And that's true. But I'd also make the argument from that just because the science had made advancements does not necessarily mean that there would have been improvements in the living standards for the people, because, you know, let's say, okay, the increase in living standards was due to, for example, the discovery of electricity. hold on, get a drink. So while that may be true, I'd argue that the property rights that people gained and the legal rights acquired under liberalism and capitalism have a lot to do with that. So take, for example, under feudal Europe. Even if somebody had discovered, say, electricity or steam power or something like that, or internal combustion engines under medieval era Europe, due to the feudal economy, where basically all property rights, not all, but most property rights were exclusive to nobles and lords, and, you know, everybody else was a serf in service to the lord, they had almost no property rights, so the fruits of their labor were not owned by them. So if you were a serf in, you know, feudal Europe, not only is your incentive to discover electricity or steam power or internal combustion much lower because you're unable to reap the benefits of making that discovery, but even the discovery of electricity, for example, doesn't necessarily guarantee an advancement in living standards, because, okay, you discovered electricity, now what do you do with that? Discovering something scientifically does not necessarily lead to tangible benefits for the common man in terms of implementing that discovery for products that would benefit the common man. And I'd argue that basically the sort of innovations that came about and invention from these discoveries are largely owed to the fact that when you not only does capitalism incentivize making these discoveries, because then you can translate and innovate these discoveries into products that you can sell for your own personal benefit. But like, say, if you had discovered electricity, what incentive is there for you to take that knowledge and then turn it into ideas such as inventing a light bulb? Or, you know, I'm not an electrical engineer, but what are they called? You know, basically those wires that, like, coil together and basically create an electromagnetic field, which can be used to, like, produce, increase, like, resistance and stuff like that. I don't know. Anyway, you know, stuff like that. Basically learning how to utilize that knowledge in ways that create products which are beneficial to people that you might sell those products to. The incentives for doing that only really exist in a system where you have the property rights and legal rights that permit you to profit from having made those innovations and bringing those products to sell to, you know, the masses. Under feudalism, basically any of those benefits would have gone to the Lord who owns all those property rights. Even if you make those discoveries and all that, you do not have the property rights which would allow for you to reap the benefits of having made those discoveries. So there's not much incentive for you to make those discoveries. So a lot of people will think that, you know, these technological advancements are just sort of a natural result of human inquisitiveness, but I disagree. I think that you need a system of profit for the people that make these discoveries, for them to have an incentive to make the discoveries to begin with. And if people can't profit from the implementation of mixing their labor with their property, then there's no incentive for them to do so. So, let's see. There's that. That was basically my main comment that I wanted to make on this, because I saw that, you know, they were sort of correlating this rise of living standards with capital, the implementation of capitalism. But I thought, you know, I'm sure that I personally know people, and I'm sure that, you know, they're, even if I didn't personally know people, that they're, it's a simple argument to make. Well, that might not necessarily have anything to do with capitalism. That just might have to do with the boom in sort of scientific inquisitiveness that came with the with the Enlightenment era. But I'd argue that the Enlightenment probably, even though it wasn't really capitalism, it was sort of the emergence of capitalism was happening around the same era, where people were finally starting to have the rights to the product of their own labor and the rights to their own property. Because before that, before the Enlightenment, under like feudalism in Europe and all that, really not even under feudalism, but like even like Renaissance era and stuff like that, you know, a lot of the major advances were made by, you know, people that had basically nobles and lords as their patrons. That's the only place where advancements were being made. And for you all you know, there could have been a commoner that was, you know, just working as a smith their entire life, that had great ideas that would have been, you know, beneficial and advanced human society and all that. But, you know, because they had no rights to their innovations and the product of their labor and their property, you know, all of that could have been taken away, you know, by their lord, and they'd have reaped no benefits from it. You know, you could have had people with great ideas that just didn't bring those ideas out because they didn't have noble patrons that were, you know, basically paying for them to make these sort of innovations. Whereas, you know, with people like Leonardo da Vinci, you know, they had rich patrons basically paying them to, you know, make big advancements in like fields of art and science. So anyway, and then let's see, it goes on from there. The next part of the article is the problem of inequality. So then he, you know, this is what the person he hypothetically is arguing with might say. So, yes, you might hear, we know socialism doesn't work and that the modern capitalist approach gives people an incentive to build and keep great fortunes, but those per capita figures hide the massive inequalities in a largely unregulated system. Capitalism is great at producing, but not at distributing fairly. And he goes on to say, again, this misreads the historical record. it was precisely the lower classes who benefited the most from the economic progress unleashed in the so-called Industrial Revolution and beyond. Yes, the captains of industry personally became quite rich, but the rise of big business primarily benefited the working class. After all, the titans of industry engaged in mass production in order to sell products to the masses. For example, in the United States during the Roaring Twenties and under laissez-faire administration of Calvin Coolidge, regular American households, blah, 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 blah. I mean, just think of, you know, Amazon and I don't want to go through his advantage because it's from the 1920s and, you know, not a lot of people will be able to relate to that. But, you know, Amazon and Walmart, how did they become rich? Well, they became rich by providing goods and services at really low prices that were able to reach people that, you know, might not necessarily have been able to afford those goods and services before. In particular, so early on, the business model of Walmart, it wasn't just to bring low-priced goods to people. Walmart, in specific, wanted to bring the sort of goods and services that you could only find in, like, major cities to more rural areas. That was their goal. They wanted to establish their supermarkets in places that, you know, in places that might not necessarily have access to the sort of goods that they were providing. So not only was it cheaper goods, but it was also providing goods to people that previously had no access to those sort of goods. Same thing with Amazon. I mean, I remember being a kid growing up back when basically the only thing you bought off of Amazon was books and music. Like that, I know that was like back in the 90s. Like basically you went to Amazon for books and music. It was like a competitor to like, to, you know, major bookstores. And yeah, it made it easy for me to acquire books and music that I would not have been able to acquire anywhere in my area. In fact, so I was kind of like a goth kid when I was growing up, and I listened primarily to industrial music, and there is nowhere where I lived where I could find industrial music. In fact, I've even gone to like Chicago, like in the 2000s, and I don't remember ever finding any industrial albums. I basically, if I wanted industrial music, I bought it off of Amazon. There was no other way to get a hold of it. Also books, like I had, there were like two or three bookstores where I lived. And yeah, they did not ever have like any of the books I wanted. So I always had to order them off of Amazon. So, you know, these were both companies that are, you know, some of the wealthiest companies in the world, and they made their wealth by providing goods to basically the poor and middle class, and not only the poor and the middle class, but the poor and middle class in areas where they could not obtain those goods. Let's see, and then it goes on to capitalism and exploitation. Fair enough. There may have been some low-hanging fruit when regular households didn't have the things we now take for granted, but in recent history, the forces of unrestrained liberalism are actually hurting the most vulnerable. Maybe not in the United States and other advanced countries, but certainly in poorer countries that are often exploited in international affairs. On the contrary, this too gets the facts backwards. So with the part I just read, again, is him basically trying to, you know, take the position of somebody that would be disagreeing with him. So as the World Bank reports, the global rate of extreme poverty, defined as people living on less than $1.90 per day, was cut in half from 1990 to 2010. Back in 1990, 1.85 billion people lived in extreme poverty, but by 2013, the figure had dropped to 767 million, meaning the number of those living on less than $1.90 per day had fallen by more than a billion people. Now, let's see. You know, actually, yeah, I'll go ahead and comment on that. So a lot of people might hear that, oh, hey, extreme poverty is living on $1.90 per day, and be like, whoa, that's our gauge of extreme poverty. It should be like living on, you know, $10 or less per day or something like that. But you got to keep in mind that in many countries across the world, you can eke out a pretty good living. I mean, well, I don't want to say a good living, but you can survive on that much. I mean, shit, even being like a homeless person in the United States, on $1.90 per day, you could at least feed yourself. So, you know, that's not bad. At least you're not starving on $1.90 per day. You can buy food. Not great food, but you can get food. I mean, $1.90 per day, that'll get you a package of hot dogs and hot dog buns, but anyway, or, you know, you could buy bread and peanut butter and jelly or whatever, but, you know, you can feed yourself on that. You might not have shelter and, you know, all the things you need to survive, but at least you'll eat. And the other thing is, like, this was something that I might want to make another podcast on entirely. Actually, I had made notes that this was something I wanted to talk about eventually, but in my opinion, people who complain about poverty in the United States have a poor conception of poverty, because they for them, poverty is, oh, hey, look, I can't afford to live in my apartment with air conditioning and a HDTV and a smartphone and cable internet and television and, you know, all these things that we as Americans consider to be like necessities of life. And these are things that even in some of the wealthiest nations on the planet aren't considered standard necessities of living. For example, in most European countries, they don't have air conditioning. In Japan, they have like window air conditioning units, and that's basically the limit of it unless you're rich. And then they don't even have, you know, heating for the summer. They sleep under their kotatsu and, you know, all that shit. In a lot of European countries and even in Japan, you know, a lot of the population, especially the poor population, they're not using smartphones. They're still using flip phones. Like, we even the poor in our country are using smartphones. I mean, some of them are still using flip phones, but a lot, you know, you'll look at poor families and they're walking around with smartphones. You know, they all have HDTVs, and they're like, our standards of living are so high in the United States that things that we consider to be necessities are things that would put you in the middle class in a lot of European countries that are, you know, considered to be pretty well-off countries. And there's actually an article on this from fee.org that compares compares, I can't remember if it's the average income of, like, it might be like the median income between nations or whatever. I can't remember, but I'll probably look over it again sometime in a later podcast episode. I'm just going to end it here because I've been going on for a while. So I guess that's it for now. I'll catch you later.